Hi, and welcome to the After Animals podcast.
After Animals uncovers trends and stories at the cutting edge of the global post-animal movement. What does a future look like in which food, fashion, and entertainment no longer have to exploit animals to be successful?
Each episode, we will share with you a remarkable and inspiring story about someone who is forging a more compassionate future for us all. After Animals is co-produced and hosted by me, Yulara Nakagawa,
and me, Sharanya Krishnaprasad. This week, I got to speak with David Benzikin, the CEO of Ocean Hugger Foods.
That's awesome.
Ocean Hugger Foods makes plant-based alternatives to popular seafood items, and their first product is Ahimi, which is a tuna alternative made from tomatoes.
Yeah, we've tried that together.
We have. I was so excited to find it at my local Whole Foods.
It was really good. It tasted super clean.
You're not the only one that feels that way. It was recognized by Whole Foods as Supplier of the Year for Outstanding Innovation.
Oh, that's amazing.
It was a great interview, and he covered so much ground. There was one part towards the middle of the interview that blew my mind. And so what we're going to do is we'll cut in at that point, and then we'll jump in, add some additional context around this topic, and then we'll jump back into David's interview to close up.
That sounds great. I'm really looking forward to hearing what he had to share.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So David, I would love to begin with what brought you to where you are today, working on plant-based alternatives to animal products.
So I spent about 10 years in the nonprofit world, leading advocacy and fundraising efforts for organizations like Farm Sanctuary and some organizations in the women's health and rights world. And I loved that work, but I felt I wasn't having the impact I wanted to. And a lot of that was around starting to measure how much I was able to influence behavior change in the public through educating them about the benefits of moving towards a more plant-based lifestyle for their health, for animals, and for the environment. One of the number one barriers that people were communicating were a lack of knowledge or a lack of satisfaction with the options that were available to them, the products that they could eat or wear or use on a daily basis that satisfied their needs. And so in 2010, I started working in the vegan business world. I started a company called Plant-Based Solutions, and Plant-Based Solutions provides marketing, branding, operations, and fundraising support services to plant-based consumer products companies throughout the US and the world. And we do this in the belief that helping them be successful is bringing the solutions to overcome the barriers that consumers are experiencing. And so we're not pushing an advocacy route or agenda. We're really using what's called pull marketing as opposed to push marketing. And pull marketing is where you make something desirable and then somebody opts into it. So they feel like they're empowered, they're choosing to participate, and they're more likely to engage. And that was the impetus for starting Plant-Based Solutions. When it comes to my passion for animals and for protecting animals and thinking about what we eat, at 7, I was on a fishing trip with my father's business, and I caught, I put that in quotation marks because the fishing pole that I was assigned to, which was, I wasn't even holding, it was held on something on the boat, caught a catfish through the eye, and I saw the pain that that fish was going through, and it really upset me. Unfortunately, at such a young age, I didn't make the connection enough to change my diet, largely because I was convinced by others that it wasn't the same as what I was eating. But at 14, when I saw somebody making crab, and I saw a crab jump out of the pot and fight for its life, I immediately realized that it was the same. And from that point on, I was vegetarian. And I moved towards a vegan diet. The day I got to college, I went vegan, and it was the best decision I ever made. The easiest and the most impactful for my health, the animals, and our environment.
Wow. It's amazing that there were distinct experiences in your life that helped you make the connection between the animals and what you were eating. Thanks so much for sharing that. Did those experiences by any chance make you decide to focus on seafood, or what else drove that decision?
I'm motivated by changing our diets across the board. But I've always thought also about being impactful and efficient and effective. And that means that I'm more interested in an ideal world on saving the most number of animals. And when you look at the number of animals who are killed for seafood, it's many, many multiples of that killed for any other animal abusing industry. So about 10 billion land animals are killed for food in the US every year, of which 90% are birds, chickens and turkeys. But it's estimated that about 50 billion sea animals are killed for food in the US every year. And even those numbers are hard to quantify because there is so much illegal fishing and so much happens in international waters where there aren't the regulations or the ways to study and estimate how much bycatch is being caught and other things like that. I also was always motivated by speaking up for those that were most voiceless. And while no animals speak our language, or we don't speak theirs for that matter, fish are among the hardest for us to relate to as human beings. And it's the reason that I think people are more likely to stop eating mammals or birds first, because they don't understand the connection. They don't look at a fish and think it's like us. But with the sheer numbers and the amount of suffering they go through, I felt very strongly about this issue. And so after a couple of very early successes working with some global meat and dairy alternative companies like Gardein and Daya and others of that nature with plant-based solutions, I was thinking about what I could do next. And I became very interested in pursuing an opportunity to disrupt the seafood space. At the time, there were almost no companies making plant-based seafood. And so I started exploring it. And I found this chef, certified master chef, James Corwell, who was making a product that at the time he called tomato sushi, and it was a tomato-based alternative to raw tuna. I thought it sounded like one of the craziest ideas I'd heard, and I had no idea how it would be, but I'd heard such extraordinary reviews that I decided I had to check it out for myself. I reached out to Chef Corwell, and over the following year, we became very close. I have tremendous respect and admiration for his integrity, for his extraordinary talent as a chef, and for the products he has created to protect our oceans. And so in 2015, we started working together. And in 2017, we launched Ocean Hugger Foods. Ocean Hugger Foods makes alternatives to popular seafood items. Our current product in the market, our flagship product, is Ahimi, which stands for the spirit of ahi tuna. And that is a tomato-based alternative to raw tuna, which we sell in food service, restaurants, sushi kiosks at stores, colleges and corporate offices throughout the US and Canada.
Yeah, I've actually tried it from my local Whole Foods and I was quite impressed. Where do you see the market going from here?
What's most exciting to me is that the demand is just endless and the trajectory is such a huge positive direction. So if you look at the growth in the plant-based space from a consumer perspective, we do have about a 50 or 100% growth in the number of vegans and vegetarians over the last decade. But what's even more impressive is the number of people who are actively reducing their animal protein consumption, even if they're not totally vegan or vegetarian, or those who are doing it like half the time. So the flexitarian population, which market research firm Mintel defines as those who eat vegetarian for more than half their meals, grew from 6 to 16.7% between 2008 and 2013. So you think about the whole history of the United States, and we'd only gotten to 6%. And then in 5 years, in 2013, we had grown nearly triple. And that was 5 years ago. That was the most recent data. So we know it's grown since then. The growth of these companies in terms of sales proves that. And so the demand is overwhelming. What's so exciting with that is that with consumers looking for these options, they're providing the financial resources and other resources to help companies innovate and come out with new things. So every day I'm being approached by brands at Plant-Based Solutions who are bringing the coolest new products to market, whether it's mycelium and fungus-based meat alternatives or algae-based milks or whatever it may be. So many new incredible products. And there isn't a product in the market that we aren't seeing an alternative for, from foie gras and caviar to steaks and sausages. So it's a really exciting time. And on Ocean Hugger front, the market has so much opportunity and so much room to grow. The Wall Street Journal said that the plant-based seafood alternative market in 2017 had a total of $9.7 million in sales compared to the dairy alternative space, which has many billions. And so it just shows where the opportunity is. And we're proud to be one of the few companies ahead of the game. We're bringing new products to market and have aggressive expansion plans to sell globally. with products that replace all of these different species, many of which are among the most endangered fish in the world, such as the tuna that we're replacing.
Yeah, I remember when I first went vegan and there were hardly any products that were available, and now there's almost too much. I don't know what to pick. And I'm always looking out for the next new product that I can try. It's very exciting. What is a new product that you're working on that might be released in the near future?
Over the next 2 to 3 months, we'll be launching Unami, the spirit of eel, which is our eggplant replacement for unagi or freshwater eel. For those who don't know, like tuna, eel are actually among the most endangered species on Earth. And the reason is pretty significant and pretty obvious once you hear it.
Okay, so Yulara, after I talked with David, I went down the rabbit hole on researching eel because I had no idea how endangered they were before I had this discussion with them. Did you know anything about eel?
No, I had no idea either until you told me, and I was thinking, well, why would we? Because it's really just not something that people in North America would tend to consider food, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I was in the depths of scientific research on endangered species in my last job. And even then, mm-hmm. I had never come across eel as a particularly endangered species or one that was to be watched in any way.
Right.
But clearly it is. So let me begin by telling you about the eel life cycle because it's fascinating. Adult eel live in freshwater, so in rivers and streams, and when they reach sexual maturity, they make a long trip out to the open ocean to lay their eggs. Those eggs hatch in the ocean, and the immature eel then make the trip back to rivers and streams where they can grow and mature so that they can repeat the cycle.
Hmm.
When they are making that reverse trip, in estuaries, which is where the river meets the ocean, that's where these glass eel are actually collected and then transported to aquaculture ponds where they are grown to maturity and then they're sold for food. They're essentially fattened up in confinement and then sold for food. What's also really fascinating is the aquaculture people have never been able to figure out how to actually breed these animals in captivity. And as a result, they just have to constantly get the supply of immature eels from the wild in order to service the demand for eel.
Right, so they can't grow them in captivity from the start. They actually have to go in and take wild stock of juvenile eels and then fatten them up as you sell for the market, which is obviously not good for the natural stocks and population.
Exactly.
And just, so when you talked about glass eels, is that a species?
No, so they call them glass eels because when they're immature, they actually look transparent. You can look through them, so they look like glass.
Oh, so it's a stage.
It's a stage in their maturity. And so it's when they're, actually, it's before they're mature. So it's before they're an adult eel. But also, when they capture them in that state and put them in ponds in large numbers together, I'm not sure, and I couldn't find out whether it was because of the stress or because of what they add to the water or what they feed them or whatever it is. But all the eels are also fascinating because they can all change gender.
Wow.
And so when they put them in captivity like that, they all become the same gender. Which means there are no males and females that can mate and then produce the eggs that will then produce more glass eels. So,
right. And so that's the reason they can't breed them in captivity.
Yes.
And how sad. I mean, you have these beautiful fish that are born. They struggle to go upstream to a whole other habitat, come all the way back through this journey and make it only to be captured and put in tanks and then essentially eaten.
Right. Yeah.
It's just kind of sad to think about.
It is. It is. While I was doing this research, I also landed on a piece that the National Geographic had done a while ago, where they talked about the business of eel. And apparently it's a big thing. In Maine, they capture these glass eels because Maine is a place where a lot of the glass eels are making that trip from the ocean back to rivers. And so they capture them and then they transport them all the way across the world to Hong Kong or to Japan, where then they're grown to maturity and then sold on the markets in the Far East.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's a multi-million dollar business.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. government tried to put restrictions on it.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, as with anything, when you have a law, people try to find a way to circumvent it.
And money, a lot of money to be made.
A lot of money to be made. Eel used to cost about $40 a pound back in 1995.
Okay.
And then in 2012, that price had gone up to $1,200 a pound.
Whoa.
That means it's grown by 5,000%.
In like 25 years.
In 25 years. And in that same time frame, if you look at the price of gold, it went up by 300% in that same time. So this is 5,000% versus 300% for gold. So it's so much more.
Yeah, yeah. It's a market. There's a market for it.
Yeah, yeah, there is.
Tons of money to be made.
And then I wanted to ask you, given that you've spent some time in Japan, do you feel like eel is something that a lot of people consume in Japan? Is it popular as a dish?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I didn't grow up in Japan, but I did live in Japan. And I have relatives in Japan, so I spent quite a bit of time there, and it's ubiquitous. I mean, you can buy it in the supermarkets. It's a common sushi on most, you know, sushi restaurant menu items. And it seems to me that the general consensus is that it's a healthy food, and it makes you energetic. And so I've actually been told by somebody, like recommended by a friend or family member, oh, you're not feeling well, like you're feeling fatigued, go get some eel, like eat some eel.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's a very common, and I think, you know, I looked at it, the numbers as well, and it's astonishing. In Japan, people consume more than 100,000 tons of this stuff a year. They call it unagi there. And there's even like eel eating festivals mentioned in the National Geographic piece. Yeah, so it's a celebrated food item in the country. So I can see why there is such an ongoing demand for the product. Yeah, from Japan in particular.
Yeah, so I'm personally just very thankful that people like David are out there trying to come up with alternatives to this wildlife
crisis.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
It can only end poorly, right?
Exactly. I mean,
whenever you take something from nature and there's no limitations to it, and it's being done illegally, then where are we headed?
Yeah, there's no good ending to the story. So yeah, I'm really glad that Ocean Hugger is doing something about this. But also, I don't want to take up too much more time right now. Let's get back to the interview so you can listen to the rest of it.
For sure.
There's a lot of great stuff still left.
Super great he shared this exciting new product with us, though.
Yeah.
Thanks, David.
Yes.
As a result, eel has gotten extraordinarily endangered, rare, and expensive. Just as an example, in 2017, the price of eel went up 8x in 1 year because the supply was so limited. Not that our concern is primarily about the price. We're concerned about the impact, but that just shows what the opportunity is. And so when we're speaking to our distributors who are specialists in the Japanese foods market, and we tell them that we can replace unagi, they're thinking this is incredible, because they're losing that business every day because they just don't have enough of it. Or when they do, they have to sell it at prices that people aren't willing to buy. But we can give them that option without that cost, without that cruelty, and without that sustainability problem. So our eel will be on the market very soon. And then sometime in late 2019 or at the latest early 2020, we'll be coming out with our carrot-based salmon, both in a raw and smoked variety. And we're very excited about that one as well. We have many other products in the pipeline. Can't say exactly when they're coming out. Could be soon. It really depends on securing the supply chain and scaled manufacturing. So we've got a ton of products that work swimmingly in a 1 pound pack. The question is, can we make it in the 40,000 pound container load? And that's what we're working on.
Wow. So yeah, you're really working on a large scale here. Where does the process actually begin for you?
We're contracting farms and we're testing varietals. Certain tomatoes have certain benefits in their look or their texture over others. Same with eggplants and carrots. We need to nail down which ones, get those seeds in the ground, get them growing, and then test them, and then try again, and then test them, and eventually get enough and get the equipment to make them in huge quantities.
Wow, so it really does begin at the seed for you.
Yeah, it does for us, and it does for some other folks. The pea protein-based meat or dairy analogs, they have the same issue. Certain varietals have feel or a higher protein content or whatever it may be, so they're thinking the same way. For some, you don't have to think about that. But with us, we're not extruding our product out of a protein isolate. Actually, they're extremely clean ingredients. Our main ingredients in our process are just the vegetable and water, and then we marinate it at the end. So our only ingredients in the ahimi are tomatoes, water, non-GMO gluten-free soy sauce, sesame oil, and a little sugar. And it's our proprietary mechanical process we developed to create that fatty, chewy tuna texture. But that means that the look and size and texture of the tomato is everything, because people aren't getting it mashed up in a slurry and reconstituted. They're eating a whole piece of tomato. We got to make sure it's perfect.
What do you see as an unexpected or surprising way that your product has been used so far and might be used in the future?
It's a great question, and one that I'm excited to answer. While we will never sell non-plant-based products because of our holistic commitment to the animals, the environment, and health, and the belief that the less we are using of the animal-based products, the better for the world, we have found one opportunity we hadn't anticipated, but that we think will have a huge impact. And that is that in addition to restaurants serving our product as is in a sushi roll or in a poke bowl or something else, for those who aren't going to choose the plant-based option, a lot of those food service operators are actually combining our product with tuna in the same dish to reduce how much tuna they're using. And I wish everybody would go vegan tomorrow, but if you're not going to, if I can get you to eat 50% less tuna, that makes a real difference for the animals, for our health, and for the environment. And the motivation for the restaurants is not just to be able to show how sustainability-minded they are, it's also an incredible business opportunity. Our product costs about a third to a quarter the price of sushi-grade tuna, and so they can make a lot more margin and more money. And we support that. We think that aligning business interests with social interests is the greatest way to make an impact. And we're proud that among protein alternatives or among animal analogs, we are one of the most successful at being able to compete on price, because we're intentionally targeting extremely premium and price volatile categories of products with commodity ingredients using our special technology. And that is unique and different, because so often to replace an animal product that is produced in such hard conditions that they can charge so little for it, you have to take an ingredient that's not yet scaled up in the supply chain and do new technology to it. We're taking very simple ingredients that are already abundant, and that allows us to do so much. So these quote-unquote blended products are similar to what you see Taco Bell doing with soy protein in their ground beef, or what you see Sonic doing with their mushroom beef blended burger. And again, it's not something I'm personally going to consume, but I think that it makes a great impact.
That's exciting that they are able to use a very different product in the same dish and have it blend in seamlessly. That's very exciting to hear. Now, I know we've been speaking a lot about the positives, but going over to the other side, can you tell me a bit about the challenges that you faced as a company?
We are bringing products to market that have never been experienced, and there is a level of education that we have to provide and confusion that we have to overcome. The idea that tomato would taste like tuna is ridiculous to most people. And even when I heard it, I thought it's either going to be amazing or horrible. Fortunately, it was the former. But that requires that we teach people about how we're able to create the product in such a way that does deliver that incredible gastronomic experience, and that we're able to get it in their mouths and have them celebrate it with us.
So along those lines, what made you decide to sell to food businesses instead of directly to consumers?
We had to make a decision about how we were going to sell it. And we're always thinking about what's going to have the greatest opportunity, what's going to make it easiest for people to experience. And because it's replacing raw tuna, we had to think about where are people buying and eating raw tuna. And clearly the dishes they're eating it with in the West here are sushi and poke and ceviche. But whether for fear of food safety or concern about not having the expertise to handle it, consumers aren't making those foods at home right now. 96% of sushi is purchased outside of the home, and the vast majority of that is eaten outside the home. So for us to sell a bag of ahimi and tell consumers, hey, roll your own sushi, we'd be educating them twice, first about the dish and then about making it plant-based. And so we decided to sell in food service, where chefs are making the prepared dishes for the consumer public. I think it made the most sense in our current state.
That kind of brings up another question then. So what does the process look like in terms of manufacturing? And then what does the shelf life look like? Is everything prepared in one location and then shipped out to the various distribution centers? Or how does that work?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we do manufacture in one place for North America. And then we have other factories coming online in other parts of the world to be able to distribute there. And our factory makes ahimi, the tomato-based tuna alternative, in bulk bags. And it's shipped through distribution to restaurants and other food service providers. We make it frozen, which has its positives and negatives. The positive is that it has a 2-year shelf life, much less, of course, when opened and refrigerated. But that means that we don't really have a concern about getting it rushed. On the other hand, it means that we're paying to ship dry ice and that we're paying to ship overnight and extremely long distances very fast, which is outrageously expensive. So people always ask us, why can't I buy this online and make my own dish? And I say, well, shipping to you would cost $300 for $30 a product. So in terms of our priorities, the amount of time we'd have to educate consumers and convince them to spend that kind of money, and the amount of money we'd have to spend to set up the e-commerce shop and manage that and create small individual packages to send out to consumers, it's such a lift. So, you know, we've chosen to go in the direction we have, and it's had its real advantages, but also its challenges.
Yeah, and actually, you can make the case for it being more environmentally sustainable for you to ship in large batches than have it packaged and shipped in smaller quantities to individuals.
So, absolutely. Yeah. We're only sending one truck for every 40,000 pounds instead of having to, you know, use styrofoam and dry ice for every 5 pounds.
Yeah, absolutely. That in itself can have such a huge impact. Now, switching gears a bit, where do you see plant-based alternatives fitting in with the cell-based or cultured meat alternatives?
With the market having so much nascent and unmet opportunity, I actually think that having more companies that are solving this problem in this space from a pure business standpoint is advantageous, because we need to educate consumers, and the more space we get on the shelf as a community, the more they're likely to see us. Not every product is for everybody. So if somebody tastes one vegan cheese and they don't love it, at least if they taste another vegan cheese and they like it, they're more open to eating vegan cheese. So I think that the more products we have, the more we win as a community, and all boats rise with the tide. As far as the opportunity and need and challenges for cultured meat or clean meat or whatever we want to call it, I think that cellular agriculture is an incredible technology to solve so many problems, whether it's for replacing animal products or others. And I certainly support innovation and research that can address the incredible climate challenges we have and animal cruelty challenges we have. While my companies and my focus has been on plant-based, I think that anything we can do to challenge the archaic food system we have that is economically inefficient, unsustainable, unhealthy, and unethical, I think is an important step forward. And so I support all of these explorations and seeing where we can go. And I think it's possible that different people in the public will have different preferences for products. Some people may want to have a tomato without any chemicals be their new tuna. And some people may want something that gives you the exact same sinew as a steak. And there's nothing wrong with that. So I think we need to pursue all options.
David, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure, and I'm super excited for what you're doing and any awareness we can bring to this movement to make plant-based living and more ethical, sustainable living more available, broadly known, and everything else. If people want to find out more about my work or my two companies, Plant-Based Solutions is online at www.plantbasedsolutions.com. My email there is david@plantbasedsolutions.com. And we'd love to hear from you if you have a food product business that you'd like to bring to market, or you're looking for support in marketing, branding, fundraising, finding a manufacturer, anything like that. We'd love to talk to you about it. And then if you want to learn more about Ocean Hugger and find out where you can find our products for yourself, you can go to oceanhuggerfoods.com. And there's a menu locator on there where you can find it just by typing in your zip code. If it's not available near you yet, please be patient. We're spreading quickly to get to every corner of the earth. But if you sign up for our mailing list, we can actually send a geo-targeted email announcing when it's in your area. So we'll know to let you know, hey, guess what? It's available in your backyard. So thank you so much again for your support of this movement. And we look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you for being on the show, David. Thank you for tuning into this episode of After Animals. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to the podcast and leave a rating and review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Or tell one friend about our show. The more people we have listening, the faster we can spread the word. Thank you. The After Animals podcast's mission is to activate a kinder, more compassionate world through innovation.
After Animals is hosted by me, Yulara Nakagawa,
and me, Sharanya Krishna Prasad.
For the animals.